Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into Native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskan.
Welcome to Chinook Patterns. I'm Paula Schiller. There is a stereotype picture of an Alaska high school classroom. White kids talking, answering questions and participating. Native kids sitting in a corner, silent and bored. In the early 1970s, Judith Kleinfeld of the Institute for Social and Economic Research found some classrooms where things were quite different, where all the students participated, the rural students along with the white kids from town. She found that some types of teachers were more effective than others in bringing out the best in Native students.
If you looked at teachers, you could divide them into a few groups. And we divided them in two ways. One way had to do with how warm they were in the classroom. We found that a great deal of what was going on was the amount of warmth that the teacher communicated to the kid. And the second way we divided teachers was how demanding they were in the classroom, how much they required of the students.
You know, in a Western classroom, or at least all the high school classes that I was into, a warmth was not particularly a relevant characteristic. I really don't remember caring if a teacher was particularly friendly or warm. Why would that be important in a cross-cultural or an Indian Eskimo setting?
In large part because the kids were very unsure of themselves and very uncomfortable. If you take an Indian kid from a village of 300 and put them in Lathrop with a population of, 1,500 or so students, the other students tended to ignore the Native kid. The Native kid very often interpreted this as prejudice or hostility. In fact, one of the common remarks we got from kids as they entered their sophomore year was that they thought people around here were prejudiced and they really weren't. Now, there was prejudice expressed against the Native kids, and the situation in which it was most likely to happen was when the teacher bent over backwards to be nice to the Native kids. That was a situation I was really surprised at. But I would sit in the back of the class and watch, and very often after the teacher had gone out of their way to make a special exception in grading or something for the Native kid, the teacher would turn his back, and that's where you get the from the students kind of imitating Yupik dialect, or a Native kid would get to leave a boring class early for a special boarding home program meeting, and the white students would get up after them and imitate their rather distinctive walk as they left the classroom. The teacher had a large part in eliciting this behavior.
We should go through some of the types of teachers, and that will explain some of how warmth and the other aspect you were talking about, which is demanding academic performance, or at least participation, how those two relate to each other and the kinds of effects they had on the students.
Sure. Before we get into that, perhaps a little explanation of why the demandingness was important as well. In each side of the relationship between teachers and students, each group had problems, and they were real problems that stemmed out of their background. It wasn't a case of either group not trying. The problem from the Native student's point of view was, what do I make of this confusing, unfriendly, prejudiced environment? And they were very sensitive to the warmth. And the problem from the teacher's point of view was, what do I do with this kid from the village? What do I expect of him? What do I demand? And think of yourself in the position of a teacher. You're getting someone in from a village that doesn't have the background academically that you take for granted among the rest of your students. Do you give him special assignments? Do you give her special tests? If you gear your expectations lower for the Native students, won't this arouse the unfairness of the other students in the classroom? And the teachers would ask themselves, should I be understanding or should I be demanding? Mm-hmm. If the kids are going back to their village, do they really need to know chemistry? right. or biology or French or math or whatever the teacher was teaching. So the easy course for the teacher was just to kind of ignore the kids. They didn't present discipline problems usually, so they were kind of left at the back of the room and given attention to occasionally. That's why the demandingness is so important. Now, whenever you put together a category system, you're always doing violence and creating something that's artificial. This category system doesn't mean that you can just pigeonhole a teacher. I've had teachers say that, well, one day they were type 1 and another day they were type 2 and so on. It's more a way of thinking about types of classroom styles, recognizing that teachers can go between mm-hmm. one and the other. But anyway, we came up with really four categories of teacher. Our first type, the traditionalist, was a type that, in my view, has been unjustifiably maligned in the educational literature of the 1970s. They were the kind of teacher who had very high academic standards, who were subject matter oriented rather than person oriented. Typically, they were men in high school. They were into chemistry, they were into math, and their first job was to get that across. And they regarded the interpersonal relationships in the classrooms as a distraction from the business at hand. The teachers usually taught by lecture method. They were more comfortable with a rather formal relationship with their students. Now, for white kids or black kids who were similarly task-oriented, these traditionalists could be just excellent stimulating teachers. The problem was that the village kids in the class usually couldn't understand what they were talking about. They didn't have the preparation. So they just sat there in the back, or they read comics, or they came late, or whatever. And they went to their counselor and explained that the teacher was prejudiced because he'd yelled at them for not doing the work or doing it badly. The traditionalist had a difficult time with village kids. The next kind of teacher was the sophisticate. This was the teacher that wasn't a very warm personality and tended towards the understanding area of the continuum, a very familiar type in college teaching. Teachers who were generally highly educated, gone to very good schools, traveled a lot, were often well-versed in the anthropological literature, and had a sincere interest in the village kids. In fact, if their priorities weren't to get subject matter across, their priorities were to help the village kids, and they really were much more interested in them than they were in the other students mm-hmm. in their class. It was their priority group. Nonetheless, the style of these teachers and the way they taught often created barriers. For example, the teachers usually preferred a discussion class, whereas the village kids were used to a very structured approach and program materials. The classroom repartee was very fast. It was very quick. There was lots of irony. The kids couldn't catch it. They didn't know what everybody was laughing at. And they would just get real, real uncomfortable in the class. The teachers would often try to slant assignments and such towards the native students. But when they did so, they were apt to fall into this trap of not demanding anything and not expecting anything. We had one example of I was watching this teacher, and the native student interrupted us, and I began to hope that the teacher was only doing this for my benefit, and that he really wasn't like this. But the kid said, "I missed the last test. What should I study for?" You know, teachers mm-hmm. must hear that 100 times a day. And he said, "Don't worry, I'll make a special test just for you. You'll do well." And the girl said, "What should I study?" And he said, "Don't worry, it'll be just for you. You'll do well." And the kid went away. Mm-hmm. So again, it was just this overwillingness to accommodate. Another problem with these teachers, and I think it really is a fault that has to be placed at the door of the university in its attempt at teaching, in an attempt to making teachers into anthropologists, is that these teachers were just fascinated by cultural differences. And very often, instead of having the kid write an essay about the subject matter, the kid would be asked to write an essay about their village or their feelings about school, and the teacher responded to it not in the sense of, is this well written? What was the grammar? Was the punctuation correct or anything else? But did the student give him interesting material?
Could the teacher learn from the student?
Exactly. That's a real nice way to put it. And it was an exploitative kind of relationship, even though the kid might end up with fairly high grades. Another kind of teacher that we identified in the research was the sentimentalist. These tended to be women, very warm, very understanding, and they had a hard time keeping the class under control, any class. Their kids would be teasing them, hanging out the windows, and the teachers would get very angry. But the native kids, partly because they weren't sure of themselves in the situation, didn't tend to be the behavior problems. So the teacher would find herself in a situation where she would be acting real warmly and supportively towards the native kids, going over to talk with them and so on, and then turning and yelling at the other kids in the classroom. Well, this was the class in which we found by far the most obvious expressions of prejudice from the non-native students, because they were very annoyed by the favoritism they saw. The other problem in these classes was that nothing much was getting taught. The teacher's whole day was kind of devoted to being warm, being friendly. Interestingly enough, in these classes, the native kids weren't huddled in the corner. They were friendly, they were talking, they were participating, but they didn't participate much in the academic part of the lesson. They tended to participate in the social conversation. What did you do this weekend with the teacher before and after the class? Nothing much happened.
So part of the first goal of making the students comfortable and participate and talk and get out of that corner was accomplished by this sentimentalist teacher, but not the second goal of actually learning something and getting information to the kids.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, our last category of teacher, the kind that was effective with the native kids, we call the supportive gadfly, was interesting because he or she would use that personal relationship in order to produce learning. And they would say to the kids, look, I'm your friend. I want you to learn because I'm your friend. This is what I want for you as a friend. So the students saw the teacher's demandingness not as a relationship to the subject matter. You know, what's important in this game is chemistry, and boy, you've got to get that chemistry. Mm-hmm. But he saw as what's important is the teacher's concern for the student. And that isn't very common among Western teachers, and the teachers were real uncomfortable about it while they saw that it worked. They would say things like, you know, I don't want you to learn for me, I want you to learn for you.
Right.
But on the other hand, the kids seemed to view learning as just part of a personal relationship, and they reciprocated. The teacher took an interest in them and in their problems and their grandmother who was in the hospital and the difficulties they were having in their boarding home. And the kids wanted to learn because the teacher was their friend. Partly it was something I do for you as a friend because I don't want you to be sad or disappointed. And the teachers would often say pretty directly to the kids that the happiness of their day depended on whether their students were learning. And these teachers did not hesitate to display academic standards and not to fall into the relevance trap. That's not to say that teachers shouldn't make things relevant. Of course they should. But the trap is to try to make everything relevant. Everything that the kid learns relates to his village or community or his immediate needs.
Recognizing that there are these types, which we understand may be exaggerated, are stereotypes of the teachers, the four types, what could school boards, superintendents, even the rural school boards that want to screen the teachers coming to their village, how do you get the right kind of teacher into the right kind of classroom?
It's a tough question. I don't have any good answers, and none of the superintendents that I've talked to about interviewing have them either. They say very often that they just have gut feelings about the kind of person who fits in and who adapts and so on. But you can often be wrong about that too.
Two things that seem to help are finding and disseminating information on who is likely to be an effective teacher and what methods have proven successful in rural and cross-cultural settings. In-service or pre-service training of teachers also appears to be very important. More about that on next week's Chinook. You've been listening to Judith Kleinfeld of the Institute of Social and Economic Research. I'm Paula Schiller, and this has been a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.